us.
May it please the court, Joan Lockwood for Ann and Gene Spradling. This case, Your Honors, involves the medical malpractice healthcare affidavit statute at section 538.225. And we are asking the court to reinstate the Spradlings' cause of action and hold first that the trial court's interpretation and application of section 538.225, specifically of the term legally qualified healthcare provider, is inconsistent with the plain wording of the statute. And secondly, or alternatively, that if the trial court's interpretation and application is correct, that section 538.225 is unconstitutional. There's no dispute in this case that Dr. Mathis, the physician who provided the basis for the plaintiff's health care affidavit statute, is a well-recognized, well-qualified expert in vertebroplasty, which is the procedure at issue in this malpractice case. There's no dispute that he would be qualified to testify at the trial of this case. There's no dispute that the alleged malpractice is not peculiar to Dr. Sprick's specialty of neurosurgery and that it's well known to a broad range of physicians, including interventional radiologists.
What's a specialty?
What is a specialty? It is not defined in section 538.225. The term legally qualified healthcare provider is defined, and that was a discussion that we had with the trial court. Dr. Mathis is an interventional.
You can only get to that if you read it the trial judge's way.
That's right.
But I was just wondering what a specialty is. I mean, a specialty, is that limited to people who have training in, for example, neurosurgery, as opposed to radiology or orthopedic surgery?
The trial court interpreted that way, and what I argued, Your Honor, and I think should be argued to make this statute constitutional, is that a specialty can be one who is a specialist in the procedure at issue, one who is credentialed to perform the procedure.
His specialty is doing these vertebroplasty procedures.
That's correct. Dr. Mathis's specialty is performing vertebroplasty.
Would you then equate the qualifications to, in other words, if you were qualified to testify concerning the standard of care, then you're qualified to sign an affidavit?
I think that constitutionally that needs to be the law. If you are qualified on the standard of care and qualified for the plaintiff to make a submissible case of malpractice, to hold that a procedural statute can erect a barrier for the plaintiff to proceed with their case is unconstitutionally, primarily because of the open court's requirement. But as well, it would deny the plaintiff the right to trial by jury. It would invalidate the separation of powers. It would be unconstitutional for a number of reasons.
But the legislature could say, in an expert witness statute, that in order to testify, somebody has to be of the same training, specialization, et cetera. The legislature didn't say that in this case.
The legislature did not say that in this case.
But it could set standards for evidentiary, for admission of evidence.
It certainly could. And right now the legislature has enacted, as you know, Judge 490.065, which governs, per the Mahoney case, per the Klotz case that this court recently decided, governs the admissibility of expert testimony. The legislature has not changed the law with respect to who is qualified to testify. What 538.225 does is it erects a barrier, a procedural barrier, to block what all agree would make a substantive case under the substantive law.
And in fact, as Judge Wolf pointed out in the McDonough concurring opinion, it's not Frye, it's not Daubert, it's a statute in a much more wider berth for presenting expert testimony.
That's right, Your Honor.
But you would probably agree that not every radiologist would be an appropriate person to execute an affidavit such as this if the surgeon or the doctor in question is as a neurosurgeon, it's not carte blanche that doctors of other, I'll just use the word specialty since we're using that word. So how can a trial court, you know, what evidence needs to be put in front of the trial court to be able to see that even though these doctors come from different areas of medicine, that that particular doctor is qualified to have executed the affidavit?
The way that I did it, Your Honor, was to attach the affidavit of Dr. Mathis, which is part of the record in the case. And the judge did review the affidavit of Dr. Mathis.
Setting out his experiences and...
It set out not only his experiences in vertebroplasty, which are extensive, but also it set forth the fact that this is a procedure that is performed by a wide breadth of specialists, neurosurgeons, anesthesiologists, pain management doctors, and primarily radiologists. 80% of these vertebroplasty procedures are performed by interventional radiologists. So this is perhaps one of those cases where you have several different types of physicians or subspecialists who would practice in substantially the same specialty as the defendant at issue.
And then narrow it would be artificial, to say the least, because the goal was, I assume, to get the people know something about the area. The diagnostician might know more than the surgeon about the diagnosis or the prescribed care or lack of care, then even the surgeon just may come in and do the surgery. And a lot, we don't necessarily want to limit, but widen the amount of people who could sign these affidavits, or it's meaningless. How does this relate to Budding? Did Budding versus SSM have any relation? Did they address this issue of constitutionality?
The Budding case did not address the constitutionality. Ken Bean, of course, argued that case, and my office was on the other side of that, and it involved the application of strict liability to health care providers. And this court widely held in that case that there was no action for strict liability against health care providers. There was no health care affidavit that was even filed in that case because it was a case that was based on a transfer of a TMJ implant. So the Budding case is really not instructive, in my opinion, to this court. I believe that the respondents cited the case for the primary proposition that the legislature can change the substantive law if it wants to, and they cite the Budding case to say, see, they did so in that case.
I remember that case well. We had three judges in the Court of Appeals and three opinions.
That's right.
Counsel, turning to the statute itself, 538.225, can you address for me the meaning of subsection 7, which talks about the hearing before the judge if defendant moves to have the court examine the opinion, determine if it meets the requirement of the section? Because one could read that, it seems to me, that if you're in a situation where the plaintiff is offered an affidavit and defendant believes it's insufficient because of specialty or for other reasons, then defendant under 7 is obligated to challenge it within 180 days. And then it specifically sets out the standard that the court is to apply in deciding whether it's sufficient. And it doesn't say the court shall look and see if you're in the same specialized field of medicine as the defendant. It says you shall look at it and determine whether there's probable cause to believe that one or more qualified and competent health care providers will testify the plaintiff was injured due to the negligence of defendant. In other words, if the interpretation of specialty is disagreed with, then the court doesn't get to go with just the names or just with the affidavit, but actually has to look at the substance and decide if you could make your case at trial.
That's right, Your Honor. And subsection 7 was something that was discussed at the trial court. And I think your reading of that and the point you make that the probable cause to believe requirement is that one or more qualified and competent health care providers is different than the term that is used in subsection 2, which is legally qualified health care provider. While 538.225 defines legally qualified health care provider, there is no definition of qualified and competent health care provider under subsection 7. When we discussed subsection 7 at the trial court level, That is when we had this discussion that, well, clearly Dr. Mathis would qualify under subsection 7 as a qualified and competent health care provider to testify.
Is there anything that says that if defendant shows that plaintiff's expert is not in the same medical specialty, as in board-certified, you know, medical specialist, that you never get to 7? Or isn't that, if defendant challenges it, I read the statute as saying then you just automatically go to 7 and you have a new test, which is would they be qualified to testify at trial?
Now, that's interesting. The way that Judge DePriest read it, because I tried to invoke subsection 7, and of course it says any defendant may file a motion to have the court examine in camera.
Right.
So the trial court said that, asked the defendants, are you invoking subsection 7? Do you intend to file such a motion? And they did not. They said, no, we don't want to.
Is there another way the defendant is permitted by the statute to challenge your affidavit other than by 7?
I think that the way they did it here was via the motion to dismiss under subsection 2, to say that I had not met the legally qualified health care provider filing that is warranted under subsections 1, 2, and 3.
Why wouldn't the statute be read in paramaterium? Why wouldn't the statute be read altogether?
I think it should be read altogether, Your
Honor. And doesn't it set out only one way? If there's the only section that addresses defendant challenging it is 7. I don't see 2 giving him a separate basis to challenge it other than as set out under 7.
But I would agree with that, Your Honor. Subsection 6 talks about the dismissal upon the motion of the party. And the way that the trial court interpreted, I believe, subsection 6 was as applying to subsection 2.
Fails to file.
But 6 is only if you failure to file.
I agree with that as well. And the Mahoney case, of course, that was decided in 1991 by this court was just that, a failure to file. Here, we have not only filed a health care affidavit, but we have filed one by a well-recognized, renowned expert on the procedure at issue. And this case is non-frivolous by definition because it meets the requirements of substantive law. Whereas Mahoney, you've got a failure to file, you've got a frivolous case, and that's the basis for the court's holding there. I see, my time is up.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. I got that wrong a bit ago when I said good morning. Judge Stiff and Judge Wolf and Judge Fisher, you were all asking about sort of the same thing, the interrelation between the case that has to be made at trial and the affidavit that has to be made that has to be filed at the outset of the case. And I think the Klotz case answers some of that. The Klotz case says, well, you're talking about apples and oranges. When you're making your case, you have to comply with 490.065. At the outset of the case, you have to comply with 538.225.
So the purpose of this, if we were to look at the purpose of the statute, would be to make sure that the plaintiff pays for, develops a retained expert and pays for an opinion from a person in that particular specialty, even though he may not use that person at trial.
Well, Your Honor, it happens very commonly that an expert at trial is not the person who provides the written opinion. And I think, as Judge Stiff pointed out, subsection 7 contemplates that once you get past the point of whether there's an affidavit, and the subsection 7 procedure is only
But subsection 7 is referring to this requirement, is it not? Because it talks about the judge is going to examine this, and then they're going to determine. Because I want to take you back to the definition itself, and we didn't talk about this, the words that come before the word or shall mean a healthcare provider licensed in this state or any other state in the same profession as the defendant and either actively practicing or within 5 years of retirement from actively practicing substantially the same specialty as the defendant. Now, it seems to me that the way that's structured, you could read that to say it has to be someone in the same profession as the defendant and actively practicing. Or if you got a retired doctor, he or she has to be within 5 years of actively practicing substantially the same specialty as the defendant. And then when you go to seven, you're looking at, well, what do we mean by what does it have to be in terms of the same profession?
Well, Your Honor, that's two things, I think. One is the construction of the statute as to whether the substantial the same specialty applies to those who are actively practicing as well as those who have retired within 5 years. And I think the more natural reading of that and consistent with the statute as a whole is that it's someone who is actively practicing or within 5 years of actively practicing substantially the same specialty, substantially the same.
I guess the problem that I'm having is that, and I guess, you know, we see this every once in a while from when we're trying to read legislation and figure out what they're up to, and that is that you could rather readily rewrite this section to make it say precisely what you say it says, and it seems to me that you would talk about the same profession as the defendant and actively practicing in the same profession or the same specialty as the defendant, and then have the qualification at the end about if you are within 5 years in that profession.
Well, Your Honor is correct that you certainly could write this statute a different way. But the way that the circuit court read it and the way that the respondents advocate is internally consistent with the rest of subsection 2, for instance. When you first read subsection 2, you mentioned the part about how they have to be in the same profession as the defendant, and that follows another or, the first or in the same subsection. It says that a legally qualified health care provider shall mean a health care provider licensed in this state or any other state in the same profession as the defendant. And I don't believe, if you take this or argument that the plaintiffs have advanced, you could read that to say health care provider licensed in this state or any other state in the same profession as the defendant. And so the license in the same profession as the defendant wouldn't apply to the first licensed. That wouldn't make any sense. You could be licensed, a healthcare provider licensed to be a nurse could give this opinion against a neurosurgeon, a physical therapist, an audiologist. It doesn't make any sense. And I think it's the same or that appears later. The natural reading of this, and this is the plaintiff's own case, the Gash case says, which is a unanimous case from this court very recently, the construction is not to be hyper-technical. It's got to be reasonable, logical, give meaning to the whole statute. And the reading that the circuit court had is the most reasonable and natural
one. But you acknowledge that there are two readings possible of this statute.
I sure don't see how, Your Honor. I don't see how it would make sense otherwise.
Can you address the specialty issue? Where do you read here that it says it has to be the same board-certified category as opposed to the relevant specialty, which is that the medical act that's at issue in the case?
Well, it has to be someone practicing in the same specialty, so I believe that contemplates.
Well, here, if you're practicing emergency medicine, isn't the relevance emergency medicine, whether you're a neurosurgeon or something else, if you're acting as if I understand your argument, if he's an anesthesiologist and you have to have an anesthesiologist even if he's acting in a primary care capacity, because you're saying it has to be his specialty regardless what he's doing, even if what he's doing is not something unique to that specialty.
Well, Your Honor, I understand your point that there might be areas in which there might be an issue as to whether someone would be in the same specialty. That is, this is not a case such as that.
If he's not acting with it. Well, but if he's acting in an area where doctors with various types of training all are qualified to do that particular work, why is that the specialty they're talking about?
Well, Your Honor, that is not something that's supported by the record in this case, that neurosurgeons and radiologists all have training.
Well, the issue here was the after-surgical care.
Don't they say profession? What is the profession? It's a medical profession.
Well, they have to be licensed in the same profession, Your Honor, and practicing the same specialty.
Are all doctors in the same profession?
I believe most doctors are in the same profession.
But in terms of specialty, and specifically this procedure, I could go to three spine surgeons or three people who specialize in spines, because I've been referred by my doctor. Just take a look at these three. I go in and I notice one of them's got a certificate from the orthopedic surgery board. Go to the second one, she's got something from the American College of Neurosurgeons or whatever. And the third one's the American College of Radiologists.
Well, and
they're all doing the same thing.
Well, Your Honor, it's possible that they might all do the same procedure, and it's possible that they all might perform a vertebroplasty.
But and the first two of those could hold themselves out as spine surgeons, and to me as a layperson, I know spine surgeon is a person who does surgery on spine. Some of them are neurosurgeons, some of them are orthopedic surgeons.
Well, Your Honor, it's true that a licensed physician can perform a lot of procedures, but the allegations in this case...
they get to do spine surgery in their subspecialty training. Does train them to do spine surgery of the same kind. Now, whether you call it, whether it's a neurosurgical specialty or an orthopedic surgery specialty, they're still operating on the same part of the back, doing the same stuff to the nerves and all that other stuff in there in your back.
Your Honor, I agree that different doctors from different specialties can overlap and perform sometimes the same kind of procedure. But what's alleged in this case is, in the petition, it's alleged that Dr. Sprick was negligent in the performance of a vertebroplasty in, I think, subparagraph C of the allegations of negligence. The allegations go, I apologize, Your Honor.
Sure, go ahead.
The allegations go subparagraphs A through O. It covers a whole lot more ground than the performance of a vertebroplasty. It goes to his performance as a neurosurgeon. There's never been any showing that a radiologist knows all about, for instance, the choice to be made as to which procedure to be performed.
Counsel, going back to the statute, doesn't it say if you provide an affidavit from someone in the same specialty, then you get to go on, and that's it. That's fine. Everybody agrees you've provided one in the same specialty. If defendant contests that you have adequately met the statute by providing an affidavit of someone in the same specialty, then subsection 7 provides defendant can challenge it. And if the court determines the opinion fails to meet the requirements of this section, i.e., as here, the court determined it was not the same specialty correctly or incorrectly, then the question the court has to answer is it goes on to decide a different question. You can't just rely on the fact they're in the same specialty. You actually look and see if there's probable cause to believe that one or more qualified and competent health care providers will testify the plaintiff was injured due to the medical negligence of defendant. So plaintiff can qualify under that regardless whether the affidavit was sufficient
yes.
to meet the automatic fact. So why isn't – but the trial court here did not do that. The trial court thought if he thought the person was not in the same specialty, he had to reject it and did not – look at this second standard.
Well, I believe that's what the statute says, Your Honor. Subsection 2 sets out the requirement for, say, 2 and 3 set forth the requirements for the affidavit. Subsection
right.
6 says that if such affidavit, which is to say an
is
affidavit.
Not, no.
It,
no,
that if such affidavit, which is to say an affidavit of a qualified one, is not filed, then
no,
the court
well,
shall
but
dismiss
then,
it.
But then 7 has no meaning because it says if the court determines the opinion fails to meet the requirements of this section, and the only requirements are to file an affidavit. So. You'd never get to 7
well,
under
no,
your
Honor, and this goes, I think, to something that's maybe not as clear. It's that what's filed is not an affidavit under subsection 2. What's filed is not an affidavit of a doctor. It's an affidavit of Mr. Woodley saying that he has a written opinion. And if the affidavit of the lawyer recites the things that you need, then you beat subsection 6. But if the defendant says, Judge, please inspect in camera the opinion, then you make a determination, it's essentially a show cause hearing, as to whether the plaintiff is going to be able to go forward with evidence that's going to get the plaintiff to a jury. It's, as the Klotz case says, it's apples and oranges between what you need to have in the affidavit and what you need to have to get to a jury.
Counsel, in subsection 2, it says substantially the same specialty. It doesn't say the same specialty. It's substantially the same specialty. And,
it does.
And when you think about the intent of the legislature, and their intent was clearly, you know, not to have like a podiatrist sign an affidavit for a neurosurgeon or radiologist. And if, in fact, as your opponent has stated, that 80% of these vertebroplasties are performed by radiologists, why wouldn't the common sense spirit of this law be followed by having someone who does that type of procedure a substantial amount of time, even though they don't have, quote, the same certification as your doc does?
If I could, Your Honor, two things. One, there's never been a claim by the plaintiffs in the response to the motion to dismiss, in the affidavits by Mr. Woodley, the affidavit by Dr. Mathis, and the court in their points relied on or in their opening brief in this case, that Dr. Mathis is in substantially the same specialty as the defendant. There was never a contention.
Well, but doesn't that mean that they performed the same procedure, or they performed it a numerous amount of times that give them enough qualifications to have an opinion about this procedure?
Well, Your Honor, it's sure possible that Dr. Mathis might have an opinion about the procedure, but he is not someone who's qualified to give this affidavit as to the performance of Dr. Sprick, a neurosurgeon, in the larger treatment of this patient. The allegations in the petition go far beyond.
One paragraph goes
to the vertebroplasty.
Well, we're not trying to prove the case at this point. We're just trying to say, you know, is there a case? You know, So why wouldn't that meet the spirit of what the legislature intended?
Well, Your Honor, if someone had advanced the theory that Dr. Mathis meets the requirement of being in substantially the same specialty, that might be a different argument. What the plaintiffs argued, what the plaintiffs admitted in the circuit court, was that Dr. Mathis is a radiologist, Dr. Sprick is a neurologist, and they insisted that there was no requirement that they be in the same specialty.
But what if both of those are qualified to perform, to do the acts that were here at issue? We're asking, isn't that the specialty specialized in the particular kind of act that's at issue?
Well, Your Honor, the evidence in the record in this case shows that they are not in the same specialty.
Well, doesn't the statute say substantially the same, not the same?
Yes, and the circuit court found that they're not in substantially the same specialty, based on the record that's
before the court. But it thought it had to be your medical license specialty as opposed to the conduct you're doing and whether both of you are qualified to perform it.
I apologize, Your Honor. I missed the first part of that.
It's okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
Are you suggesting that's a question of fact as opposed to a question of law?
Well, the construction of the statute obviously is a question of law. But whether Dr. Mathis is within substantially the same specialty, that's absolutely a question of fact.
Then why isn't it unconstitutional and irrational to have a requirement that you have to meet in order to stay in court that has nothing to do with whether you can prove your case?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it has nothing to do with whether you can prove your case. And this is a presumption.
You've just said it requires something very different, though, than what, in fact, you'd have to prove at trial.
It does, and that's what the Klotz case says, that they're apples and oranges. But what
I don't think the Klotz case approved this on this basis.
No. I understand. But it goes to this point that the affidavit is separate from Section 490.065, and the presumption that the plaintiffs have is that the affidavit sets a higher burden. There is no evidence in the record to support that. Having an affidavit from a neurosurgeon is not inherently a higher or lower burden.
If this court were to find it set a higher burden, would that make it irrational, unconstitutional, or a violation of the open court's provision?
Well, if the court found that having a higher burden is caused by this statute, it would not be based on the record in this case. The record in this case is bereft of any evidence that their plaintiffs would be at any other time, difficulty, or expense in obtaining the affidavit of someone who's within the similar
But you're telling me they're proving that they could present a qualified, one or more qualified health care providers who would make their case for it and show probable cause to believe medical negligence caused the injury would not be sufficient under the statute, because that's what 7 lets them do as an alternative. I thought you're saying, no, they have to prove an affidavit instead that shows something different.
The procedural affidavit requirement requires, no. I apologize, Your Honor, requires an affidavit that there is a written opinion from someone within a similar specialty. Yes.
And why is that a rational requirement if you don't have to have a similar specialty at trial?
Well, Your Honor, they are two different, as the court said in the class case, they're two different requirements. When you're just getting in the door, after the case has been filed, within 90 days after it's filed, how is it irrational for the legislature to ask for the plaintiff to be able to produce an affidavit that there is a written opinion from someone within a substantially similar specialty? And, Your Honor, that is a lower burden than the plaintiff would ever have to meet in proving the case. The written opinion doesn't have to be under oath, doesn't have to be within any reasonable degree of medical specialty as far as the statute says. The written opinion is to be held by the plaintiff and can be only explored in camera later. It's a very much lower burden than get to the jury.
I agree. Doesn't it actually make sense that the affidavit requirement should be interpreted as to being a lower burden than what's later admissible?
Oh, Your Honor, by the plain terms of this statute and 065, this is a lower burden. This doesn't put a higher burden on the plaintiff.
Okay. So if that's true, if this is a lower burden, and this person would be eventually allowed to testify at trial, which you can have a hearing to determine whether or not that's accurate, then why doesn't the affidavit necessarily establish and satisfy the affidavit requirement? In other words, if it's demonstrated by the affidavit that this person would eventually be allowed to testify, then doesn't, and then that's a more stringent standard than the affidavit requirement, then doesn't it necessarily satisfy it? If the judge has made a determination that it would later be allowed to give their opinion, why wouldn't that necessarily satisfy the filing requirement?
Well, Judge Fischer, the way I understand that question is it irrational or absurd or unreasonable to have the affidavit requirement especially?
You agreed with me that it was a lower burden.
Yes, it is right.
And so if it's a lower burden, and the higher burden is that it will be admissible, if there's a determination that this person is qualified to testify later, then why wouldn't that necessarily satisfy the lower standard of the affidavit?
Well, and Your Honor, if someone would satisfy the court under subsection 7 that they would be able to get to a jury, well, then the statute by its plain terms would allow them to go forward. Your Honor is asking about what would happen. First, you have to have the affidavit. If it doesn't comply with the statute, then you can have the in-camera inspection of the opinion and essentially a determination of whether the plaintiff's going to have enough to go forward. That's what the statute says. Where we are is at step one. For the plaintiff filed an affidavit that's not, as the plaintiff admitted, from not someone who's within the same specialty. And the record doesn't support that he's from within a substantially similar specialty, and the plaintiff's never argued that. Now, the case was dismissed. And the plaintiff's remedy is to refile the case with an appropriate affidavit. Apropos of which, and I apologize, I know I'm over my time, if I could have the court's indulgence.
You have a little more time. Mr. Teitelman is waiting for you, too.
I would be pleased to answer Judge Teitelman before I go anywhere else.
I'm not going to prolong your agony in it. It's just more of a statement of, that, you, as always, Mr. Bean, you've argued superbly and with questions coming from every direction, and I admire your skill as an advocate.
Your Honor is very kind, and Your Honor has promoted me to Ken Bean.
You did very well. I can't see very
Your
well.
Honor, that would be chucking me several rungs up the food chain. Mr. Bean is with us this morning, but I'm at first.
Another testimony I can't see.
Okay. And my vision's going too. If I could have just 30 seconds or 1 minute, I apologize. This is not a case that is appealable. The plaintiff has a remedy by refiling the action. The plaintiffs in this case, filed an action against Dr. Sprick on March 24. This is not a case where the plaintiff lacks a remedy or needs to appeal to this court. I appreciate the court's indulgence. We ask that the judgment of the circuit court be affirmed.
Thank you.
So I want to give you the most time as you can, Ms. Lockwood, so come on over. The standard of review, I mean, it's fact, law, what? So if it's fact, is it abuse of discretion? If it's law, it's de novo. What is this?
The standard of review for the application of a statute is de novo. However, the court does give deference to the trial court's factual findings. Here, Your Honor, it is our position that the trial court misapplied and misinterpreted the statute, which would be a de novo review standard.
But following up on Judge Stiss' arguments about the constitutionality, which I kind of enjoy, the open courts and also Judge Fisher's, I mean, should we have two standards, or should there be just, why should we put the apples before the oranges with respect to the jury finding in the case? What's the problem of just, like any other case, having the case in front of the jury? Of course, the statute says what it says, but is there the constitutional issue might be a higher standard than the statute?
Certainly, if the statute is interpreted and applied the way it was in this case, 538225 is unconstitutional on a number of grounds. The access to court issue, if you apply the three-part test that this court established in the Kilmer case.
But isn't the state's justification for that, and I think that it looks like a higher standard to me in the affidavit stage, is that you have to pass the affidavit stage before you can put the defendants to the trouble of doing discovery and all of those kinds of things. So it's a threshold that you have to meet to get into the courtroom, to the courthouse, to get to run up the expenses for the defense. So that's isn't that a rational basis for it, for its existence and for its different interpretation than was interpreted in at the standard at trial?
Certainly, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that's what the Mahoney court said. If the purpose of the statute is to pretermit the action,
yes,
to dismiss a case that we know will not meet the requirements of substantive law, it is constitutional. The reason this case and this statute differs from Mahoney is because we filed an affidavit and because we do meet the requirements of the substantive law. We are not being allowed to pursue a substantive cause of action where we have a qualified witness who will testify on the deviation from the standard of care.
Did you have an obligation to say they were in substantially the same specialty because they had expertise in the relevant operation or care?
I'm glad you asked that, Judge. The very fact that I use Dr. Mathis as the basis for my affidavit shows that I believed he was in substantially the same specialty as
You're saying you don't have to say the magic words if it's implicit?
Exactly. I mean, I argued that to the court. I argued he was credentialed to perform vertebroplasties. I argued that he was board certified and had board certified in neuroradiology. So we had an extensive discussion on what the statute required. I did concede that he was an interventional radiologist and Dr. Sprick was a neurosurgeon, and the trial court was fixated on that requirement of same specialty. I was arguing substantially the same specialty simply by using Dr. Mathis as my expert.
Opposing counsel says, while it's a different requirement from how we look at the opinion given at trial, it's not a higher one, it's simply different. Can you address that? That the affidavit requirement is not necessarily higher. In some ways it's easier to meet, in some ways it's harder to meet.
It's a higher requirement in this case because I clearly would have a submissible case under the law with Dr. Mathis. I think what he was saying was there's no right for them to review the opinion of the healthcare provider, and it's not done under oath and subject to cross-examination. While that is true, I am certifying, Mr. Woodley is certifying, that we have obtained the opinion of a healthcare provider who's reviewed the records, is familiar with them, is familiar with the procedure at issue, and is willing to testify to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that there was a deviation from the standard of care. So I disagree that in this particular case, my burden was less than it would be at trial. In fact, that's the constitutional problem with the way this statute was applied in this case. I've got a higher burden, I've got a procedural barrier that violates the Missouri Constitution the way it was applied here.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.